Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's Sunday, October 27th, 2013, and welcome to episode 61 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computing news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm Carrington Vanston, and I get to be host of this outer limits of retro computing, where it's just the two of us out on the edge. In fact, there's nothing wrong with your headphones. Do not attempt to adjust the podcast. We control the transmission. We control the horizontal. We control... How does it go? We control the vertical. I guess there's no horizontal or vertical, but we're controlling it anyway.
We control the pixels.
Yeah, we control the pixels. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer round table. Anyway, so this is the RCR.
I was going to try and hum the theme, but it's not really hummable.
And I'm clearly punch drunk. And the person there who cannot hum is my co-host, Earl Evans. Hello, Earl. How are you?
Good, Carrington. And you, my friend?
I'm excellent. A little slow this morning, or this afternoon. I guess it's afternoon now. I went to a Halloween party last night, and it was super, super fun. And I was dressed up as a pirate.
Awesome.
And it was a good time. I had an eye patch, a hook hand, a parrot on my shoulder, and a bag of free software to give away.
Very nice.
Software and music and stuff. It was great. So it was fantastic. And what about you? Have you done any Halloween shenanigans yet?
No, not yet. We've been too busy.
Will you be giving out candy? Is yours the sort of house where kids come by?
We wish that it was, but our neighborhood tends to be so stinking quiet. It's actually quite disappointing. Oh. But every year my son and his friend Ben get together, and they put on a Halloween extravaganza over in Ben's neighborhood. I mean, they have all kinds of technology that they use for this, which is really fun. This year they're using LED lamps controlled by an Arduino.
Holy
that are
cow.
Going to be dancing to the music, as it were. And also there's even a quadcopter involved in this year's Halloween. So yes, they do quite a show for the, and it's great for the kids. You know, they come and they have a good time.
Very impressive.
So yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to seeing. I'm looking forward to seeing this extravaganza that they put together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get no kids at my door either because I live in a condo. So
yeah, it's just, you know, we have a house, but it's just kind of boring. We live down toward the end of a dead-end street, and just nobody comes here. So, boo-hoo.
You got to put a free candy sign on the side of your van.
Yes, we do. Arrows.
Well, cool. So, shall we talk about a topic that is my choice?
I think we should.
Well, I'm the host, so I get to pick the topic of the week. And the topic of the week, I am giving the title "Lost to Progress." See, this week my sister had me copy over, digitize some stuff from an old VCR tape, and it was a pain, a super pain. Some stuff I hadn't had to deal with for a while. For instance, finding a VCR. So I had to find the VCR, then I had to find the cables, figure out how to get it into my computer, and that wasn't too bad. But then it was an old commercial tape, so it had Macrovision anti-piracy stuff on it. So then I had to remember how to strip that out, and it had been ages since I did any video hacking. So it was such a nightmare. There were so many things put in between me and digitizing this for something that nobody cares about. It's not like a sold thing. It's not like it was an actual movie or something. Like, there's no reason not to have this. Just it was a pain because of the format it was in. It was a pain because of the file format. It was a pain because of the technology. And it was a pain because of the DRM. And it got me thinking about the fact that for essentially thousands of years, literally thousands of years of human progress, what we decided to record, either on paper or chip into stone or whatever, had a good chance of still being around and still being accessible. And now, for the last, like, since my lifetime, almost everything that we think is important is presented in a way that it almost certainly will be lost to time. It cannot be kept around.
You would think that digital would be more durable.
I thought when I was young, I thought that was going to be the case. Hey, we'll never lose any data anymore because everything's gone digital. But the reality seems to be we switch file formats, we switch physical formats, we have DRM, oh DRM, how I hate thee. And all that stuff conspires to mean like the essays that I wrote in junior high are almost impossible for me to get at because it's such a pain, and not that I'd actually want them. And it's not really about my essays, but it's about drafts of novels and just like so many things and so many notes. And I look at the things that people have gone through to recover data, the interesting stuff that happened recently with them finding the source code to Prince of Persia and everybody gathering around and sort of rescuing that. And that's exciting. And it's exciting, the stuff that Jason Scott does and the people over at archive.org to save things and actually archive them. And that's exciting and awesome. But it seems that the great ocean of data, for the most part, will just be gone. And I always worry that we don't know what we'll want to have. Like, it's easy to say, oh yes, this latest Stephen King novel, we should keep that around. But we, like, lately I've been videotaping whenever I unshrink wrap boxes of software, because I'm thinking maybe somebody later will want to know what order the documents were inside the box. I don't know that somebody would want that, but maybe they would want to, and I have a chance to save that bit of knowledge. So I don't know. It seems to me, like I wrote in our show notes, I wonder, did going digital, the way for the most part we have in Western culture, did that mean that we would necessarily have had to turn into what seems to be a short-term data culture, or could we have gone a different way? Discuss.
I don't know if we could have taken a different approach to it. I think that so much of computing is evolutionary that it just sort of happens and you don't see it coming. So I don't know if there would have been a way to plan ahead and say, hey, we know different formats and different media and that kind of thing are coming down the line, and so let's do all of our stuff in some sort of open documented fashion where it will be durable. I don't know. I mean, that would have been nice, but in reality, I don't see that happening. I think at this point, though, we've got enough experience under our belt that we really should start to think about those sort of things. Just the other day, I was looking at some documentation for an old fourth package for the Commodore 64. And it turns out that the documentation was written in what's now an obscure word processor for the Commodore 64. I was having trouble finding it. And I mean, even if I did, what form would I then export it to that would be easily readable in some modern day sort of word processor? So, I mean, I completely agree with you in that it's a pain. I just don't, I'm not sure that I see a way around it.
Yeah, it's just
I feel like there's two things about the digital culture today that make it unique and then present unique challenges. One is, I think that we're actually creating or collecting more information than we ever did. With everybody,
your government certainly is.
Yes. Yeah, who says the government never listens to the people?
That's all they do, man. I keep thinking I'll look on my Twitter feed and I'll say I have a new follower. Who? The government. They're following me.
No, they're a lot more stealthy than that.
Oh, I see. Well, they'll spell it wrong.
But so much is being collected by our smartphones and our computers and our webcams and, you know, and little snippets too. Have you noticed that where we used to do long-form video, long-form audio, kind of like this podcast, that today a lot of the popular stuff is just, here's a one-minute video on YouTube.
Yeah, it's faster and faster.
Here's a 10-second video on Vine.
Vine, like, which is taking off like crazy, and like 10 seconds and faster. Like, how quick can you do your little joke, basically?
I feel like digital should be more durable and robust, because a copy of something digital is a 100% fidelity copy. Whereas before, if you wanted to take that stone tablet or that paper and make a copy of it somehow, you'd have to have monks sitting in a building transcribing, or, yeah, I'm not even sure how you would have copied the stone tablet.
And then there's transposition errors. They make mistakes.
Exactly.
Well, nowadays we skip that step. If you look online, we mostly jump right to the spelling errors. So we are getting faster that way too.
So we'll have a 100% fidelity copy of something that wasn't correct in the first
place. But then we'll blame it on transposition. For every time I make a spelling mistake from now on, I'm going to be like, monks, those darn monks.
So we're just determined to have errors. Yes. No matter what. If we can't have them in the copying, we'll just insert them from the beginning.
It's mostly because I just try to think. I'm thinking about this stuff like really long term. It's not about the pain, and it is a pain right now for me to get at stuff from 1982 and 1983, and that's not in the general scheme of things that long ago. But I'm thinking, like, if we had access to the same fidelity of recordings for, you know, 5th century BC Egypt or something, like, how amazing it would be, just somebody walking down the street with a high-def video camera, what that would mean to us to be able to look at that and hear the texture and really see things in a way that we're just sort of guessing at now. Wouldn't that be amazing? And we have the chance to do that for people 5,000 years from now. And if we're already struggling to get access to things from 15 years ago, 5 years ago, how is that going to work 1,000 years from now when people are completely removed from even the context of what we're trying to do? How would somebody, like right now, people who are better at this than me were able to recover the Prince of Persia source code. But I wonder, could somebody do that in the next generation? Like, if we didn't have Tony Diaz, we had now, and hooray for that. But what about Tony Diaz the third?
Right.
Could he do it? Hey, Tony, could he? Teach your children well, Tony.
Also, where does the information go is another question. Here's a for instance. So I have home video of my kids as they're growing up.
Cool.
So, yeah, hooray for me, right? And a handful of people on Earth would be interested in seeing that. And probably that subset is even less than I think it is. I'm probably, you know, boring some people. But let's say that one of my kids becomes extremely famous.
Mm-hmm.
And then 500 years from now, people are going, wow, we wish we had Joshua or Jessica's home videos. We wish we had the record of what life was like.
Yeah, wouldn't
for them
we like Christmas home videos of Shakespeare?
Because,
yeah.
Exactly, because they, you know, invented the cure for cancer, or they found a way to create a completely sustainable clean energy source. And they're a hero.
That.
But where is all of their information?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've collected it. We didn't used to. 100 years ago, we didn't used to collect it. The best we had then was photographs.
But people are super into genealogy. I'm not, but lots of people seem to be. And they make all these charts of the past people. And wouldn't it be cool if that chart was essentially like an advent calendar for your family? So when you click on the name, it says, and here's videos of them through the air. You can really get a sense of who they were and where you came from. And I don't know. It's one of those things where I don't think
if
we know now what we'll want
all
to know later.
If people give a darn at all, I would love 1,000 years from now for my descendants to be able to click on something and see our family get-togethers or whatever. I bet that would be extremely exciting for them. But how in the world is that information going to be passed on?
That's a good question. And maybe this is all just me being selfish. Maybe it's because I think people 1,000 years from now should be interested in me. They should want to get at my blog and my podcast.
I'm sure they will, Karen.
And I hope they will after what I've got planned 10 years from now. No, I'm kidding.
Well, now your blog and your podcast, that's an interesting
thing.
Where
does that stuff go? When I stop paying for that blog domain name, eventually CarringtonAdvanceden.net and .com will become, well, everything, every time a domain lapses, it becomes a porn site. So, but then after that, in the post-porn existence of a lapsed domain name, what happens then? I mean, I guess archive.org keeps it again, but I don't know.
I was just going to say, isn't Jason Scott and that kind of activity the answer to your query?
I don't even think it's that kind. I think it's Jason Scott is going to save the universe. Because if not him, then who?
You won't get an argument out of
me.
And kudos, Jason.
Yeah.
Thank you for saving the universe. One bit at a time.
As part of the universe, I appreciate it.
Yes.
Well, just the thing is, like, for me personally, I have it was about 5 years ago. It was too early, but I knew if I didn't jump on this way of thinking, I would never do it. So quite a few years ago, so let's call it 3, I decided that there was infinite amount of storage. And I was no longer deleting everything. I was keeping every draft of everything because it's such a pain to get rid of stuff at Arc. It's just easier to just go to bigger and bigger storage. So I just constantly get bigger and bigger storage. And my backups are just included in my old backups. So when I finally get rid of a hard drive, it gets archived. And on it are all the... It's like turtles all the way down. On it are compressed archives from all the earlier versions. So every time I make a new backup, that backup has all the previous backups. They just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Intriguing. I've done essentially the same thing.
So I've been thinking lately, and I have a software project where I've been working on, and they've asked me to implement software that way, where there's no save. All it is a ribbon where you go back and forth, like reimagine word processing type things where there is no concept of saving. There's just data dumped in and everything is kept constantly. It's this government thing. So it's been interesting to look at that and deal with just like a sort of a time slider instead. How do you implement that?
But it's like Time Machine.
Well,
time machine
that kind of thing, but just live. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that kind of idea where just everything's there all the time and there's no such thing as a lost anything. We're just going to record everything all the time, always go. And just can you deal with that? And so far my answer has been, no, I can't deal with this, but we'll see what comes of it. But what I found interesting is that mental switch to start thinking about, no, hard drive space is infinite. It's so cheap, it might as well be infinite. I don't care, keep everything, was a real change in my overall sort of valuing of data archives, because partly they became a pain because I had to get better at searching because I couldn't spend the time to file that much info. But partly it became me thinking, I wish I had started thinking that way in the 1970s. Like, I know I would have had, like, no computer, but still. And then just said, no, from now, always, all my floppy disks, just archive them to something bigger, take that to archive to something bigger. Because now I look back at the size of what I considered big drives and big storage before, and it's laughably tiny. And so what I have now is laughably tiny to me 5 and 10 years from now. When I first got into filmmaking, I'd spent a ton of money because I went right into digital stuff, and we were saving them on, I think they were 60 gig hard drives, which, like, to me was crazy, 60 gigabytes, because I remember buying 1 gigabyte hard drives, and they were bonkers expensive. Now I laugh at that because I can't buy thumb drives that small. It's just like, it's just crazy. They were just, and at the time it was these massive things. And now I'm like, whatever, just make a couple of archives. Who cares? So I think that I'm trying to deal now and think about hard drives and think about my data storage with pre-retro thinking. So dealing with sizes and files now with in mind, what do I want 20 years from now when today becomes retro computing? What do I wish I had done in the way that I wish I had done it in the 80s? So I've been doing things differently because of that, trying to pre-retro think. But the VCR this week, in dealing with that and dealing with something before, thinking, oh my goodness, Macrovision? Really? How do you strip that? I can't remember. It was just such a pain, and old data formats are such a hassle, and I think needlessly so.
So the open standards world would jump in there and say, first off, we told you that DRM was defective by design.
So I agreed with that. I did.
Trash it. And secondly, they would say, we also told you that you should focus on open data formats as opposed to proprietary data formats, because in theory, you'll always have a way to read those open data formats. Now, that contention I kind of wonder about, like, today everything's XML and it's all beautiful structured data, but 20 years from now, 50 years from now, I think there's still going to be some of those same challenges. But another interesting point, my mind's going 5 different threads at a time here because this is such
an Earl.
Interesting topic. So you and I, as we talk about this, we find we've got a strategy for that, as you called it, the turtle or the little, what are those little Russian?
Oh, the little babushka dolls?
Yeah, exactly.
Nesting dolls, yes.
Where this goes inside this, which goes inside that. And that's all well and good for us. We're techies. What about the general population that's collecting a bunch of data that they're going to want to keep? And it's hard for those folks as they migrate from one technology to another. And we know this stuff ages in dog years. And so how do they make sure that they don't lose all their data? Or worse yet, that their data doesn't get lost in an ocean of data that they're sitting around going, well, I know I've got that video of Josh's graduation, but where did I put that? What, you know, what media is that on? What backup is that on? How can I index it? How can I get to it? It's data overload.
Well, I keep thinking if something is open and accessible, there will someday be a tool that lets you dive through and dumpster dive in your data and find it. We have facial recognition now that I could retroactively apply to digital photographs in the past.
So,
and I bet you will be able to do the same thing with video or audio samples. If I can hold up my phone right now and in 5 seconds it'll tell me, oh, here's who's currently singing that song and here's where you can buy it, there's no reason I couldn't speak into a microphone and say, please retroactively go find me in this conference. Like, go find me. So that tool will probably come. The main thing is just to have the data to have accessible. And speaking of XML, it bothers me when we take a glorious thing like that, like, hey, let's make it open and tagged and humans could read it. And then you get companies like Microsoft changing the Microsoft Word format so that it's using like data dumps to say, well, no, go here and look in memory to this version of Microsoft Word, and that's where you'll find to read that bit. I was like, well, that's defeating the whole purpose of using XML, you boneheads. That stuff I don't like.
Yep. The proprietary stuff is the stuff that always gets us. And now we've got enough experience.
We should know better.
Right.
But I don't know if it's always just proprietary. I think it's also the nature of the format. It's okay, I think, if it's proprietary, if it's something that you could easily go through and
well,
look at.
Well, if it's proprietary and documented, that's
yeah,
one
the
thing.
Documented formats are the things I really care. Because honestly, I don't care about barriers of copyright or DRM because I just blow right past them and that doesn't bother me. What I care about barriers where technologically something is saved in a format that's like just completely impossible to search through. And I think, oh, that's such a nightmare. Since I was quite young, I used to be quite good at, in fact, I almost always, if I save something in a word processor and I would save it. And back then I used things like MacWrite and WordPerfect versions and Nicis Writer and like things that would be a nightmare to open nowadays. I would almost always save out a plain text version or maybe an RTF version as well. So frequently I've been able to go back to earlier things to get it republished or whatever, and I can just open up the RTF version. So I sort of saved
How
by those.
How prescient of you.
Yeah, because I used to be much, much more into open standards and open things, even than I am now. I've given in, and I'm now old, and I prefer beauty and ease to actual openness. And I find open software is also just so ugly. Like, oh, I just want to give up and use a Mac. Like, and so I do, and I feel ashamed sometimes, but it's so much nicer, and it's got taste, and I like that, and I'm old, and leave me alone. But I've always been very good at also trying to save things out. But some data, things like video, I guess I mostly save stuff in H.264 format, and that's very proprietary, but everybody seems to be able to get at it. But can I get at it later?
Well,
I don't know.
Well documented. It's an actual name standard.
But for me, from a retro standpoint, like focused for this show, I'm trying to think now with, like I call it pre-retro thinking. Like what will me, and what will all of us 20 years from now look back on the way we're using today when today is now retro, and we shouldn't necessarily paint ourselves in corners that make old us mad at younger, well, older us mad at current old us.
Well, I think that not only have you found a niche there that could make the world a better place, but also could be a good business opportunity.
I'm way
so,
too
hey,
lazy.
RCR listeners.
You go do it. I'm too lazy.
That's right. Yeah. All you entrepreneurs out there, save us from ourselves and from our ocean of data.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's some thinking. I thought we'd just brainstorm on this idea of data and loss to progress and stuff, because I do find it an interesting topic because it's bit me so much in a retro standpoint, and I worry it's going to bite me in the future too. So,
man, that was a great topic.
So let's get to news, though. Let's get to some serious retro action. Let's get our retro freak on here, Earl.
All right, let's do it.
Let's start with you and Forth.
Okay.
You do
Shall
love
I
to talk about Forth.
I tell you, I warned you that I'm just obsessed with this stuff. But I found a great video series on YouTube. Again, ephemeral data. Somebody out there archived this stuff. This is Learning Forth on Atari 8-bit systems. And I just love the Atari 8-bit systems. Of course, I love so many of the old 8-bit systems. Mm-hmm. But it's a pretty computer. And this particular video series is very well done. It takes you from just the basics of Forth, like how does it work? What can I do with it? Into some quite detailed work on the Atari. The fellow who's putting this together had the goal of putting together a graphic demo, and he wanted to use Forth to do that. And so therefore, you have to start digging into the guts of the Atari 8-bit systems, how the ANTIC chip works, et cetera, to be able to do that. And so he's done that in this series of videos. I'm through part of them. I'm not all the way through. I've enjoyed everything I've seen so far. And I think if you're either interested in Forth or interested in Atari, or not interested in either, but just bored, that you ought to go take a look at this video series.
Okay, I have bookmarked it, and we'll have a link in the show notes as well. But that sounds really interesting to me. I think the computer that is creeping up on me the most. I never was an Atari guy. I was always sort of aware of it, but my battles were between like Apple II and Commodore, and all the people I knew were either Apple II people or Commodore people, and then eventually everybody became a PC person, really, except for me. But I didn't run in any Atari circles, so I didn't know anybody there. There were some TRS-80 guys, and I had Model 1, a Model 3, and a Coco, I think, but I never was really in that world much. So mm-hmm. I have so little experience with Atari outside of the video game consoles. Like, to me, Atari was always the 2600, the 52, the 78, not sure. The 8-bit computers. Never used them. But I have completely fallen in love with the Atari 800 form factor. I think it's now my current favorite looking computer ever. So gorgeous. And I am increasingly thinking I want to dip my toe in the Atari world. I've been listening to the ANTIC podcast, and Atari people seem to be pretty friendly. And like, there's a whole history and interesting games and stuff that's unique to the Atari 8-bit systems that I really can see me next year taking that on, like as a secondary computer love. I think I'm gonna maybe keep my eye out for an 800.
Cheating on Apple a little.
I am gonna cheat on Apple, absolutely. As long as I don't filthy my hands with Commodore, I think I'll be fine.
So I had the good fortune of selling the Atari 8-bits in a couple of the different computer chains that I worked for back in the 80s. And that's otherwise, I don't know that I would have had any exposure to right. those computers. But there was a thriving user group in the LA area, and those folks were a lot of fun as well. So that was, I'm thankful that I had that experience. And I also really... I'm just so much falling in love with YouTube and all of the how-to show-me-how videos.
Holy
that are
cow,
on there.
There's some great ones.
I don't know what in the world, and I got to do some of my own because I feel like at this
point... Yes, you do, mister.
I am just being a taker and not a giver. And
I'm a carrier, so does that count?
So I got to be a giver, but there's so much to take out sure. there. It almost sucks up all your time. And this is one of those examples where he says, hey, you want to know how to do this? I don't know how many people are going to want to know how to do this, but if you want to know how, here's how.
But again, that's also about saving it for posterity, like putting it out there.
Yep.
And it's not about like I've been working on a video podcast for ages that still hasn't launched. And the whole goal of that one has been right from the beginning, like I'm never really concerned with size of audience when it comes to podcasts, but I'm particularly not concerned when it comes to these video ones. And I'm not really not the thing I'm going to be doing is going to have such niche appeal, so unappealing to almost everybody, like it's that I'm anticipating getting like 2 and 3 views, and I don't care because I'm trying to make these videos very much for a long time audience, not a current entertaining audience. So and so taking that mindset as well, so much of YouTube is about okay, try to get people to watch your video and try to get subscribers and do all that stuff, and I think I'm going to opt out of all of that and go, here's a video for 4 people over the next 50 years and very, very particular niche. But there are some great videos for people that show you. I love the how-to retro videos, and I love the people that are showing really great detail of retro things, like the way Terry Stewart, his videos. I just adore them. Like, he's got such a great collection, and he does these great videos to say, I think the latest one was the Power Macintosh, oh, I guess Macintosh PowerBook, the 145B. But he does mm-hmm. these great videos that show you like the computer sort of in action and really like detailed of here's the front, here's the back, here's how they compare, and love them. And a bunch of videos, if I wish I could remember them so we could bookmark like a few different people that are doing those how-to videos and descriptions and I love that stuff. YouTube is amazing for that. It's a great service.
You could spend 24/7 on YouTube.
And I shall.
You really could. So what do we got next? You have something here.
Oh,
Mad Dog Carrington.
That's my new name, baby. Mad Dog. Mad Dog is, as I put in our show notes, an 8-bit-ish online horror adventure game. I love adventure games. Love them, love them, love them. And so this one caught my eye. I think I found it through Reddit. We'll have a link in the show notes. And it's really more of a choose-your-own-adventure game, like those old books. So it's not a typing game. It's not like Zork, where you type, take sword, kill dragon, you know, drink babelfish or whatever. Instead, this is one of those, it'll say, this happens, do you look in the glove box or do you not, or that kind of thing. And so this is a horror adventure game with 8-bit-ish graphics. It looks more like photographs that have been monkeyed around with to make them look 8-bit. But what I like about it is it's online. It only takes a few minutes to play. Like, you can play it through in 10 minutes. There's multiple endings. And I dig it. Like, it even though it's not a true vintage 8-bit retro thing, it has the same feel. And I think it's been well implemented for web use. You can lean back, you just read, use your mouse to click on stuff. And what I like is it's got a soundtrack that plays simultaneously on the bottom. So you're watching a text adventure game in a sense where you're just a clicking choose your own adventure game, but it's got some multimedia because you've got these color 8-bit-ish looking photographs and spooky music playing to set the mood. So it's really fun. So it's called Mad Dog, and I played it and I really liked it. And I think people who like vintage 8-bit adventure games will dig this, and it'll take you 10 minutes to play. So it's a short investment and super fun. And it's Halloween theme related. So this is my choice for the first bit of news. I like it.
Yeah, that's good. Mm. This is good for our Halloween episode.
Exactly. See, look at me keeping on topic. They don't call me Mad Dog for nothing.
I know I don't.
Yeah, so the game is called Mad Dog, and we'll have a link in the show notes.
Very nice.
So what do you got? What do you got to possibly compete with Mad Dog?
I might actually be able to compete this time.
Hit me.
So a gamma ray spectrometer. That sounds pretty cool, right?
It sounds like you could turn me into the Hulk with it.
Like something you might find on a tricorder.
Or I guess it's a Hulk tester. So you go, oh, this room is clear of Hulks.
Yes, that's nice. Right. It's a Hulk detector.
Nice.
But and it actually can be used.
Sorry, it can, I'm not be letting used that one go. Hulk detector?
Also,
that's awesome.
As a checking out the radiation levels after the Fukushima disaster over in Japan.
Yeah.
But this gamma ray spectrometer is special because it's not on a modern octa-core computer system with a 512 gigabyte GPU. It's on a Commodore 128D.
That's crazy. That can't be useful.
Believe it or not.
Not.
It is useful. And if you go to c128.com and to the link that we'll have in the show notes, you'll see actually a pretty extended video of, I believe his name is Tomi, and he's demonstrating how he's taking the readings from this gamma ray spectrometer, feeding them into the processing power on the on the 128. It doesn't have much processing power. And then you can see the graphics of it coming up, even get a printout of the spectrum of readings on a Commodore printer. I thought this was amazing.
You know what? That is amazing.
And a pretty funky use of this old technology, but it works. And it's programmable and you can understand it. And the graphics were good enough resolution to show you what you needed to see. So if it works, don't fix it.
Nice. You know what? That's pretty cool. Now, is it the case that I get charmed by stories like this? I love it when it's something that it's an older computer and it's still perfectly good for using in the modern world. And I hear about some company still using an Atari ST or an Apple II or something. And I'll think, yeah, absolutely. Those things were great computers. And if they can still do the job, why not do them? Is that because I really think that? Or is that because I'm now old and I think, yeah, I still have use. You should still employ me. I might be slow, but I can get the job done. So I wonder how much of this is just my personal insecurity. But I do think it's a pretty cool story.
Well, I don't know. If I were doing some sort of interface to the outside world before I discovered that I could use microcontroller systems as a bridge, mm-hmm. I might have preferred an older computer to a newer one just because I know I have the ports on the older computer that were designed to make it easy to interface with the outside world. On
right.
a Commodore, for instance, you've got the user port, which is a 8-bit parallel input-output port with a card edge very well documented, easy to use from either basic or assembly language, and lots of people used it for varying purposes. The ham radio operators back in the day loved it because they could interface all of their gear and
sounds like an awesome tattoo. I should get that point as a tattoo.
And with that in mind, I might have gone with something that was just easy. You turn it on, you can program it right from the get-go, and you don't have to worry about buying a bunch of external stuff to interface it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe what you're feeling isn't all just old man nostalgia. There may be some truth in it.
Right. Okay.
Of course, the modern people in the scientific community will probably email me and say, we've got fantastic A to D and D to A converters and project boxes and USB connectors into external interfaces and all kinds of crazy stuff
right.
in the lab that you never knew about, so you're just silly and go away.
And we've unpaid minions who are working their way through college. We've got them to do all the hard work. I don't need an easy computer. I got Johnny here.
Exactly.
He makes me coffee and he has to transpose all these numbers. What do I care if I make Johnny's life easy?
But if you could do this with a 128D before and you still do it now, then yeah, I guess I'm of the mindset of why not, other than if it breaks, then that's a pain in the neck because you can't just go down to your local Best Buy and purchase another one.
Right. Yes. Right. Okay. Yes. Good point. Anyway, good story, though. That's remarkable that a Commodore 128D could be used for that. So,
and posted, I believe, by Mr. Bill Hurd.
Oh, nice.
Coincidentally, the inventor of the Commodore 128.
Right, he's probably keeping his eye on such things.
So what about, you've got something here on Myst?
Myst. Do you remember Myst, the game?
I
remember. Yeah, I was a big Mac user back in the day, so we loved the fact that Myst was one of ours. Ours, I tell you. So I think it came off, I think Myst was originally developed on a HyperCard stack, if I remember correctly. So Cyan was the company that made Myst and also the follow-ups. So there was this article that actually came out at the beginning of the month, so it would have come out before our last show, but I only stumbled across it a couple of days ago. So I guess it's 20 years, it's remarkable to me, it's been 20 years since Myst came out. To me, like, I can't believe it was that long ago, but it was 20 years. It was 1993 is when it got launched, according to the article, same year as Doom. And this is a nice catch-up article. You can think of it as sort of, where are they now? So it's looking at Myst and gives a bit of the history of Myst and the follow-up games that came, and then talks about the people, and it's more about Cyan and where they went, like the main artist, how she went off to do other things, that the one main guy in Myst, I think his name was, I can't remember his name, but he left to become a priest. And so he's now a pastor, and they had this one building that was like one of their main development buildings that he has turned into a church and he holds services there. So one of the places they used to develop in is now a church where the guy is now a pastor. So I was like, wow, he took a different, and then the Mr. Rand, I think, was the other main developer, and he ran a Kickstarter to try to raise money to do like sort of the next thing in adventure games, or he'd like to do something else, and he tried to raise, I think they put it that he tried to raise $400,000, and Kickstarter, he got $3.3 million. So a lot of people are seriously into Myst, and what I didn't know, although I loved Myst, the game, I remember playing it at the time and adoring it, it is still, like, there's an annual conference thing that happens just about Myst, and it was talking about the different things people have done, and some person spent $10,000 to create a real life replica of the Myst book, and you can play the game in the book just for themselves. Like, some people are seriously still into this game, and there'll be a new game coming out from Cyan because of the Kickstarter being successful. And at the end here, it talks about how they're not going to tell you what the title is or anything about it, but the teaser is a white picket fence and an old farmhouse on a strange alien world without explanation for how they arrived there. So that intrigues me because I'm an adventure game kind of fan. So I thought this was interesting because it deals with this article is worth reading. If you're into Myst, if you're into that era of adventure games, like that era of the point and click, you know, almost real quality sort of images, and they're little tiny video windows. So Myst is sort of the big name in those. And it was interesting to read about the history of Cyan, had the big boom they had after Myst, and then the big bust they had subsequent to that, and never really, you know, sort of reaching that high again, and then the different people going off in different directions, the one guy becoming a priest, and the one gal just going off to other things, and the one guy now saying, no, I want to come back and do the next sort of Myst. So if you're into that game, and you're into that era of games, you'll probably find it a very interesting article. It's called Writing the Next Age, and it was on a company, or it's on the Pacific Northwest Inlander, which I think is a website for either a magazine or a newspaper. I don't know, but it's a good article.
And I always love those people stories and also the business stories. You hear it time and time again of the computer business that became just skyrocketed into success and then all of a sudden took a ballistic turn and crashed and burned, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. That was so common.
Well, they talked in specifically in here about how the struggles they had with the publisher subsequently, like the guys at Cyan, like trying to convince the publisher what they wanted to do with subsequent games and butting heads, and how they find that they're in a different world now. Like the publishers are almost becoming irrelevant to their type of game. Like you just make it, you stick it on the iTunes store, and there you go. You're done. Like you are your own publisher. So I think that they're quite excited about the new publishing landscape. But Myst is one of those games I have a real soft spot for. I adored that game. Did you ever play it?
I didn't.
Oh, you're missing out.
I didn't ever play it. I've seen it.
It holds up. Yeah, the graphics are no longer that. Like when I first played it, it wowed me with the graphics. And there's a few versions of it. There's one called Real Myst, which is sort of like higher resolution Myst. And then there's another one that I think is not called Real Myst, but something else where you actually, it's done in like 3D where you can move around in the world, but it's not quite as high resolution as the high resolution one. I never remember which is which, but they're both readily available now on sort of every modern platform for both, you know, regular PCs and also for mobile things. But it's a great game, and I think it's got like truly universal appeal because it's a game that's just about you're walking around on your own and there are puzzles, and for the most part, it's just you interacting kind of quietly with a world. It's a game that's at the pace of like creaking boards and rustling wind, and you sort of walk around this amazing looking weird island and eventually chain of islands that are just interesting sections where here's where there's this boat and why is that boat there, and here's the observatory and here's a rocket ship and what's going on, and it's beautiful looking, and the puzzles are beautiful, and it's got a neat backstory to it that unfolds at a leisurely sort of pace. It's I think one of the all-time great adventure games, and yeah, I strongly recommend it even to modern players. It is one of the great retro games that you can still easily play on a modern platform.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, I will have to give it a try.
Yeah, we'll wait. Go do it now.
All right.
Go.
I'll be right back.
Awesome.
Right, pay attention, Bond. This is the Sinclair ZX Spectrum Plus 2. It's a fully operational computer with 128K memory, but it comes with 3 James Bond games and a light gun that fires armor-piercing shells. Now that's your assignment. No, no, don't sit in that chair! Sorry, Bond. Haven't perfected that yet. The Sinclair ZX Spectrum Plus 2.
So I think that wraps up our news for this week. A little short on news, but there's only so much happening this week in the retro world, it seems.
Well, that's okay. We can move on to what sort of things we should buy, because we know we like to buy stuff.
Buy stuff for me, you mean? It's time for us to talk about what people can buy Carrington. That's going to be the name of this section.
This segment of the show brought to you by What Can You Buy Carrington?
Brought to you by Carrington's Greed. So, and this actually, I try to be creative with my host gift choices. And this is one that actually wouldn't even really be for me. But I've tried to, every once in a while, I try to come up with something that's a little different than just the, oh, here's a product you can buy. And like the stuff where previously I said, hey, get 12 retro magazines and send them to somebody as a fake subscription, but a subscription from 1982, that sort of thing. So this would be a similar sort of thing. If you've got somebody in your life that you're looking to buy things for, maybe for this Christmas, and they're a retro game lover, particularly they're a lover of, say, the old Atari games, Atari 2600 in particular. So let's say somebody's a 2600 fan, or you think they might be. So what you would do is you get them a 2600 or maybe a Atari Flashback or some way that they can play Activision games, or you buy the Activision games on a portable or something. And then here's the twist. Go on eBay and buy Activision patches. Activision used to have this thing where if you got to a certain score, you could take a picture of your television and you'd send it to them and they would send you back a patch for achieving a certain thing. I never got any of them, but they're still gettable and they're not huge money. And well, sometimes people want crazy money on eBay, but for the most part, they float, they're readily available, and you can get them relatively cheap. And I was thinking this would be a cool thing to do for either like a friend of yours or a spouse or children and say, hey, when you play all the Activision games and when you get a score of this high, you get to have the patch. So you can turn it into their own little brownies or own Boy Scout sort of thing. Or just like as a collection, it might be fun if somebody's in retro games. I think these would look really cool put up in a shadow box just to hang on the wall or something. But I think it'd be more fun to give them out one at a time as people achieved things, either in a relationship or playing games. So I'll have a link to eBay and we're to kick things off and basically doing a search for the Activision patch. But you can find them and there's lots of different patches available for lots of different games. So I think it would be a fun little retro gift for somebody.
This is a great idea. And as you know, Portland is a real enthusiastic city for retro gaming. Mm-hmm. And some of my buddies in town have talked about these patches and their excitement about these patches. It is a very good idea.
Well, I was thinking, like, if you had a retro event, let's say our past co-host David decided to do another retro event, you could have a competition there. You could make little ribbons that link them to that competition and pin them in and say, okay, now we're going to play Stampede and High Score gets the patch with the ribbon. And I think you could incorporate them into fun retro things. So I just thought I'd float it out there because I often forget that these patches existed. So I thought I would choose them in general as my Activision patches general computing gift.
Very nice.
Yeah. Not really computing, but it's retro. So, you know, cut me some slack. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a very fine line between retro gaming and retro computing.
Fine. Right? It's fine. That line is fine. So turning to auctions, more things that one could buy for, say, me, I've got two choices this week. The first is something on eBay that it comes up every once in a while, and I just, you know, I would like one, but I'm never going to drop the kind of coin these get. It's the personal software version of Zork. So this is the Zork Infocom before it's Infocom. So it comes in that little...
This is going to go for a lot of money.
I think so, yeah. Still some time to go. I think it's well over $100 already. It's going to go for quite a bit. It's not super rare. This particular edition of Zork comes up quite a bit. I don't think it's this particular one, but it's not like you can't get this, but yeah, it always goes for like $200 or something. So, which is a lot of money for essentially a floppy disk that's images out there. Like you can play this game and it's not an Infocom box. So it's not coming with a lot of feelies. It's just a floppy disk and a little folded thing of instructions, but it is the, you know, the pre-Infocom version of Zork. So makes it super collectible. But my real choice this week, I went a different way. I always go on eBay because that's just the easiest place to look for things to buy. But I thought this time I would pick something on a different site that I frequently forget exists. There's a site called GameGavel.com, and it's another auction site where people do both auctions and buy it now things. And it's particularly game oriented, but it's retro game oriented. So if you're looking for, there's also computer things, and I'm going to pick a computer oriented item. But if you're ever looking for something for a Commodore 64, for an old BBC Micro, for, you know, Apple II things, this is another source of those. And it's got a pretty thriving community. So definitely someplace to bookmark and look out. So I'm going to choose Gremlins 2, The New Batch, because that's a movie I love and a game I've never played, for the Amstrad 464. And you don't see a lot of Amstrad stuff come up on eBay. So here's an example of why you would look at a thing like Game Gavel. So I'm picking that on the Game Gavel site.
Well, that's an awesome pick. And I think, you know, one of the things, we're both in North America.
Yes.
So to an extent, we both kind of resonate with what the North American retro computer scene was. Mm-hmm. But of course, people are listening to us from all over the place and lots of people from Europe. And so the computers that were big over there are very interesting too. The only thing that I regret is that I don't really have a chance to get my hands on them all that often. But something for an Amstrad is great.
Totally, yeah. And this one is the cassette version for the Amstrad, mm-hmm. and it's only $4 to buy it now for $4. Somebody come on.
The gentleman who sent me the Spectrums, that I have, which I'm still yet to do all the work that I need to do to connect them up to a PAL monitor and get power for them. But he also sent me a lot of tapes because the two Spectrums that I have both have an integrated tape drive.
Oh, sure. Right. Yeah. I like that form factor with the built-in tape drive. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was the plus 2A that I have and the plus... Was it the plus 3? I'm trying to remember exactly which models. But yeah, they're the wide keyboard, nice, you know, full-stroke keyboard, and the built-in tape drive.
Right.
Very nice-looking units. So
yeah, very cool.
Lots of software came out on tape for those babies.
And it's the plural of spectrums? Is that like spectri or something?
Now, wasn't... So the spectrums were at some point assimilated into Amstrad.
Oh, you had to ask Terry Stewart. He would totally know more about this than me.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember at what point that happened,
right.
Whether or not the spectrums that I have are actually Amstrad spectrums or if they were still Sinclair.
I think they were still Sinclair as long as they had cassettes. I think it was the later one. Remember how it switched? So I always, when I think of the spectrums of that era, I always think of it like keyboard on the left and on the right is like the built-in cassette player with those cassette buttons. But then I think later... is when it switched and it had the floppy drive on that side. So when you're looking at the like 128K version or whatever, it's got the Spectrum with the floppy disk instead. And I think it was in that era that it got merged. Oh man, I'm totally talking smack though. I could be completely wrong about this.
Well, I'm going to go do some research on it
because
I'm kind of curious about that.
The only Spectrum I ever really played with was the ZX Spectrum. You know, the little smaller form factor with the terrible keyboard and the colored stripe on the right-hand side. That and the ZX80, or ZX81, I guess, are the only two of those computers I ever really had any on-keyboard time with.
Well, I just can't wait to get these things lit up. I just got to figure out how to do it. So that's my deal.
Very cool. Good choice. So what are you going to pick for your – what do you have to go up against Gremlins 2, the new batch, on cassette for Amstrad for only $4?
Oh my gosh, I have something that's so nerdy.
I like it already.
You can't even believe how nerdy this is.
I already don't believe it.
So, of course, there was a world before everyone had a programmer-capable handheld calculator, right?
Yes, there was.
But people still needed to work with this crazy hexadecimal stuff. So here, what I have in my eBay auction is a Hexamatic 16.
Okay, and I'm looking at this and you win.
You just can't beat, you can't even beat the name of this, the Hexamatic 16.
Hexamatic, I mean, fantastic, guaranteed. I love it, absolutely.
Guaranteed programmer elastic.
Nice,
yep.
Look at this thing. Okay, describe this for our audience, because I'm looking at it and I'm loving it.
Describing it verbally is going to be a challenge. Imagine a slide rule, except it's not a slide rule for doing mathematics. It's a slide rule for doing decimal to hexadecimal conversions. And you've got a card inside of a holder, and the card slides to the left and the right, and that changes the location of certain things that are peeking through the holes of the outer enclosure of the card. And so you can slide this card left and right and do your decimal to hexadecimal conversion manually using this card.
It is super cool. And because that's really what it is. It's just basically a card. I don't even know how big this is. It might be the size of a business card, but you slide it over. And then on the back, it's even got, and it, oh, look at this. And it's got the whole plus four. Like, this is cool. So the one side, it converts for hex for you. And then on the back, it's got the binary, it does a hex to decimal equivalent for which digits and for in the binary.
And not only that, but you can add and subtract hex if you look at the last picture.
Oh, you can, yes.
Option. You just slide the little thing in to do the subtraction. You have the number that you're subtracting from. You slide the card left and right to expose in the little window the number that you want to add or subtract to, and then you get the result.
This is super cool for something that's not digital at all. This is a sliding piece of paper. This is great. I've never seen this before, and I love it.
The Hexamatic 16, don't leave home without it.
You know, I actually really want this.
So that's my pick.
I mean, it's $14.50 and doesn't ship to Canada, but I don't know if $15 for a piece of paper is good. I could probably build this, but it wouldn't be called a Hexamatic 16. which is part of the name.
Yeah, that might be. I mean, 1451, that's a little rich for this.
And it sounds like a Commodore drive, a 1451. Didn't all you Commodore people have weird numbers for everything?
Yeah, pretty much.
Anyway, I love it. I love your choice this week. Our listeners definitely should check out the show notes and take a look at the Hexamatic 16. Good choice. Nice find.
Thank you.
You win. Well, and that pretty much wraps us up for things you can buy, for things you can look at, all of that. We can just go into a bit of closing discussions. I've already talked about what I did this week, and the main thing was struggle with a VCR. I was victorious, so go me. But wow, that was way more difficult than it should have been. Back in the day, it was easier to copy things than now. And the other thing is I picked up a couple of books on building robotic arms for the Apple II. So how to make robot projects and interface with the Apple II. I don't know what I will do with that, but I feel that that is knowledge I want to have. So I'm excited to read them.
I think that's great.
I know. I'm very excited about it.
Are these, so these books, I take it, these are old books from the 80s.
Yep. Old vintage games. Exactly. And they say here, basically the whole thing, like build a robotic arm, how to build the interface, how to make them interface with the cassette port, interface with the joystick port, or how to interface and make a plug-in board, and then code examples of how to then make the arm pinch and move, and how to make a robotic arm, and then have it run off your Apple II. And I've always kind of wanted to do something like that, build a robotic arm and connect it to a vintage computer. I wanted to do it back in the day. And those kind of kits come up on eBay a lot, but they're usually $2,000 and $3,000. Whereas I just, you know, drop $5 in a book and figure I can build it myself.
You can probably harvest parts here or get some cheap parts on eBay there.
I'm used to harvesting actual limbs. So how much can more difficult be to harvest robotic limbs?
I don't think it's that much more difficult.
Yeah. Robots are going to wake up in a bathtub full of ice.
Like, that's right.
Oh no, my robotic kidney robotically gone.
I knew I shouldn't have gone for that lady robot. She was trouble.
I'm gonna be out at bars buying drinks for robots. Hey, what about you, Earl? What have you been up to?
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, surprisingly, I've been playing with Forth.
Is a shock.
I know.
You've never mentioned
messing around with this on the Parallax Propeller. And there's a couple different versions of Forth for that. And it's fun when you can use a high-level interpreted language and make, like, little LEDs blink and motors
absolutely
turn.
Yes. That is just – that gets back to the original retro joy of computing I loved at the day, where you type something in and then there's this immediate reaction. It used to be the thrill of, oh, my goodness, I've just typed this and it's on screen. Or when I was early modem stuff, I just typed something and it's on that person's screen and it's on my screen, too, if I'm in full duplex. And I'm seeing – like, those little – moments are so thrilling, and I find it's the same thing with modern stuff. If you're playing with like a little Raspberry Pi or a Propeller or something, and you go, I typed this bit of code and that light came on, that's a thrilling moment.
So I'm totally going to do something, I think, with this that the inventors of it never imagined.
Excellent.
This Forth uses a Propeller is an 8-core microcontroller. So it actually has 8 things going on at once. And the people who made this microcontroller really thought about, like, I don't want to have interrupts. I want to have, like, just a whole bunch of cores handle the inputs from the switches, and the other can handle blinking the LED lights and that kind of thing. So the people who made this Forth kind of took that into account. And it's a multi-threaded Forth, so you can have multiple Forth interpreters all going at the same time and talking to them over a serial line.
Very nice.
So I'm going to have a couple of instances of the Forth interpreter running and tie them into my VT100 terminals and take a video of this, because it's just such a dumb thing to do that, you know, I feel like some people will go, wow, that's cool.
I'll be one of those people.
It's so crazy. The other thing that we were doing that I mentioned before the show is that my son's been working for 10 years on getting his black belt, and he succeeded yesterday in the test, in his black belt test, and so we were all very celebratory.
Absolutely. Yesterday. Your son is now black belt. He's already made demands for a bigger raise in his allowance. That's the downside
to
power.
Which I have to assent to, because he can now seriously kick my butt in 15 different ways.
Well, no, technically now I guess it's illegal for him to kick your butt. So you can say, I'm lowering.
Ooh, that's right.
I'm going to lower your allowance.
Answer a deadly weapon, pal.
No, that is an amazing achievement. Like, that is crazy.
So, So yeah, we've been kind of busy on that for the last week or two, which, you know, and he's very relieved that now that's over. Mm-hmm. He's pretty nervous about that.
Well, but, sure, no doubt. I mean, but that's a big achievement. That's really exciting. Well done, him.
Yeah, yeah, I was a proud papa.
As you should be.
So that's what's been going on in my life.
Very exciting.
And I've got a few bucks in my pocket now, and I want to go buy some electronics. And I want to buy one of those NeoPixel rings that we talked about last time.
Last week, yeah.
But I cannot. Why? Because they're out of stock.
Oh, that's annoying.
And I know, I think I know why they're out of stock, because people were using them for Halloween costumes.
Oh, of course. Well, yeah, yeah, absolutely. In fact, you probably would have too.
I very well might have, but no can have.
Well, for next year. Next year's costume.
I'm just going to have to wait.
Yes, you're going to have to wait. So very cool. And it'll only be a short wait for our listeners. Earl and I were talking. We're finally on the cusp of being able to announce this chess match where I will be defending the honor of the Apple II. It looks like I'll be using not Chessmaster 2000. I'll be using Sargon 3 for the Apple II, or Sargon 2. Sargon, whichever one I have sealed. I'm going to open it and it'll fulfill its destiny. And you will be using something that's already proven to be able to beat Sargon.
but I don't know. Can I beat software that's been freshly unshrink-wrapped?
I know. It's all going to be ready to go and all
you
young
might
and
have
youthful.
The karma advantage.
Plus, who knows how the time... We're going to be doing these with short time limits for the move, so maybe that will give one of them an advantage over the other. But anyway, we will soon be able to announce the date. It's coming up, and people should be able to watch the game live where the Apple II takes on the Commodore 64 for World Chess Championship.
Yes, that will be lots of fun. Mm-hmm. And to our listeners who thought, hey, have you guys forgotten about that? No, we have not.
Nope, just working out the logistics.
It's coming.
It's coming very, very shortly. And then in the meantime, thank you very much for everybody for listening. And if you're interested, as you should be, in the stuff that we've talked about, everything that we've talked about will be on our show notes, which you can find at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show notes and discuss Earl in our forum.
Don't do that. We want good stuff.
Which is at vintage-computer.com/VC forum, or just head over to rcrpodcast.com and click on the forum link. That's easiest. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to us by emailing feedback@rcrpodcast.com. You can talk to Earl by getting on your roof and shouting, "Hey, Earl," really loudly. He is guaranteed to answer you.
Well, that's if you're in Tigard, Oregon.
Well, no matter where you are in the world, Earl can hear you. You can special that way.
That is awesome.
He can hear you most clearly, though, if you're the kind of person who has gone on iTunes and given us a review. Then you come in crystal clear to Earl, so that's the easiest way to make sure that you get your answers from Earl. So thank you very much for listening, everybody. Thank you for podcasting with me, Earl. And until next time, Retro Compute! Talk to you soon.